Yoga in all its forms has been a support for me in my life, through all the highs and lows. It's opened my mind and my heart in ways I never knew were possible. It has been a teacher, a taskmaster, and a friend. This podcast is an offering. I wish to share the teachings of yoga with you as a tool to help navigate life. Namaste, and welcome. Welcome. I'm so happy you're here. So you, as listeners, may or may not be aware, but we have a book club. The book club, the Om Tara Yoga Book Club, has been in existence for, I don't even know how long, probably 15 years, I'm guessing, but definitely for the life of the physical yoga studio. And we have continued it for the last 4 years since the studio closed its doors. And in this book club, we go into different topics. We'll read a novel because there's always life lessons in the pages of someone else's life, even if it's a made-up character. We will read books that are memoirs, definitely. And we read books on what it means to witness beauty around us. So and by the way, if you're interested in joining us for the book club, you can contact me through the website, omtarayoga.com, omtarayoga.com. So I thought I would share some highlights from our most recent selection, which is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor E. Frankl. And we just met recently for this book, and it was a wonderful discussion. So if you're not familiar with Man's Search for Meaning, or maybe you read it freshman year in college, as we discovered seemed to be a popular occurrence for some of our attendees in the book club, Viktor Frankl begins this book. It's a two-part book. He begins the book while in a concentration camp during World War II as a prisoner. And he enters this situation as a doctor of psychiatry and having already begun to write a little bit on logotherapy, which is a form of therapy that he brings to light for us. It's opposite to what was very popular at the time, which was Freudian style therapy. And he already goes into this situation of being a prisoner in World War II with a manuscript, an actual manuscript. And so the first part of the book is about his experiences in the camp, as well as his observances of everyone there, from the prisoners to everyone that is there. And the book then goes into the second part and talks about this logotherapy, and it's all really born out of what he learned through this experience about human nature, about what it means to search for meaning in a person's life. So I'm going to share some excerpts for you. If you could see, I have the physical book in front of me right now, but if you could see my book, it's got blue post-it notes on almost every page. It is one of those books that if you are a highlighter or an underliner of books, as I am, you could highlight something on every page or maybe even in every paragraph. But I'm going to share with you some of the things that really stuck out for me. And again, either you've never read the book and this will inspire you to pick it up. You read it again many years ago and maybe you'd like to reacquaint yourself at this stage in life. Or maybe you're just going to take this episode as a standalone. Your choice. So I'll skip the forward, which is a really wonderful forward, and I'll jump right in. The truth that love is the ultimate and the highest goal to which man can aspire. So he talks about his wife, who he's separated from. She's somewhere in the camp or maybe in another camp. And he talks about his wife and his thoughts of her. And he says, that brought thoughts of my own wife to mind. And as we stumbled on for miles, slipping on icy spots, supporting each other time and again, dragging one another up and onward, nothing was said, but we both knew each of us was thinking of his wife. Occasionally, I looked at the sky where the stars were fading and the pink light of the morning was beginning to spread behind a dark bank of clouds. But my mind clung to my wife's image, imagining it with an uncanny acuteness. I heard her answering me, saw her smile, her frank and encouraging look. Real or not, her look was then more luminous than the sun, which was beginning to rise. And this is when he then writes, a thought transfixed me. For the first time in my life, I saw the truth as it is set into song by so many poets, proclaimed as the final wisdom by so many thinkers. The truth that love is the ultimate and the highest goal to which man can aspire. The salvation of man is through love and in love. I understood how a man who has nothing left in this world still may know bliss, be it only for a brief moment, in the contemplation of his beloved. One of the things I'll share with you about this book that was very obvious to me, and I was also somewhat surprised by it, but also it was realized by the other book club attendees, was that very much the teachings of the Buddha are throughout this book, one of love, the truth of suffering, and this meaning of happiness. So as he goes on, he mentions this one, he talks about this one concept. He says, as the inner life of the prisoner tended to become more intense, he also experienced the beauty of art and nature as never before. Under their influence, he sometimes even forgot his own frightful circumstances. And I was reminded when I read that, you know, the inner life of the prisoner tended to become more intense. He also experienced the beauty of art and nature as never before. I was listening to an interview, a couple of interviews in the recent past by the actor, writer, director Dan Levy. And some of you may know Dan Levy as a writer and actor on Schitt's Creek. The wonderful show, Schitt's Creek. And in the interview that I listened to, Dan was speaking of a time during COVID when his beloved grandmother passed. And it was really for him, if I recall the interview correctly, it was really for him the first great loss. And so he was overcome by grief. He loved his grandmother very much. And plus this was in the container, if you will, of COVID in its high manifestation, I suppose. Not sure how to put that, but 2020 or around there. And if I got the interview correctly, what I took away from it was he was on a walk with his dog and grieving, you know, terribly for his grandmother. And just really, I got the feeling from him that he was really having that all too familiar feeling for many of us that we don't know that we're ever going to come out of this. You know, like sometimes we just feel so weighted down by certain emotions, grief being one of them, that we just think, it's how's this ever going to be lifted or transformed in any way? And he says, and then it began to snow. And he was so overcome by the beauty of the snow that for a moment it was realized, he did realize that he was able to hold both the pain and the loss and the grief, but still be in touch with the beauty of nature right in front of him. And that, he says, was one of the inspirations for a recent movie that came out on Netflix called Good Grief that he wrote, directed, and starred in. It is vital to our existence that we continue to keep our eyes open and stay awake and alert to the beauty that surrounds us, be it in art or be it in nature, wherever it appears for us, because life is hard and life does have suffering in it. And I believe truly that that is why art is created and that that is the greatest gift of Mother Nature, to be able to create such beauty for us in order to, I don't know, survive the more difficult, grief-stricken and trauma experiences that we have. He later goes on, I'll jump ahead, way ahead, and he talks about the consciousness of one's inner value is anchored in higher, more spiritual things and cannot be shaken by camp life. And so what I gleaned from this, my interpretation of this, is that when one is anchored in higher spiritual pursuits, aspirations, when one has faith, when one has a relationship with the divine or the God of their understanding, that creates such a solid center for us, and such a solid core, that we are unshakable. The things that happen in our life, they can rock us about and toss us about, but our center holds. And that center is anchored by our connection to a spiritual aliveness. It is in doing this, in anchoring ourselves or in having the connection to these higher, more spiritual things, as he puts it, we are continuing to stay connected to our own essence and our own soul. And so life will happen to you. It does. But you will find that you are less shook. Or maybe I'd rather say you're tossed around, but you're not eviscerated. You come back because you're anchored in higher spiritual things. And he says in another excerpt, he says, "What about human liberty? Is there no spiritual freedom in regard to behavior and reaction to any given surroundings? Is that theory true, which would have us believe that man is no more than a product of many conditional environmental factors, be they of biological, psychological, or sociological nature? Is man but an accidental product of these? Most important, do the prisoners' reactions to the singular world of the concentration camp prove that man cannot escape the influence of his surroundings?" And he goes on and he says, "There were enough examples, often of a heroic nature, which proved that apathy could be overcome, irritability suppressed. Man can preserve a vestige of spiritual freedom, of independence of mind, even in such terrible conditions of psychic and physical stress. They would witness men walking through the huts, comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way." You've probably heard that quote of Viktor Frankl's before, but I offer that we really let that sink in. We really allow ourselves the opportunity to meditate on that. The last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And I will say that a number of the things that stuck out for me in this book, and there are more than what I'll be sharing with you unless we choose to do a part two, they could be meditations in themselves. I would be able to sit in meditation or go for a walking meditation. We've discussed all the different options of how to meditate or how to become in a meditative state. But to just meditate on that phrase, on that sentence. And there's a lot of that in this book, a lot of those offerings in this book. So every day, every hour, were offered the opportunity to make a decision which determined whether you would or would not submit to those powers which threatened to rob you of your very self, your inner freedom. He says, in the final analysis, it becomes clear that the sort of person the prisoner became was the result of an inner decision and not the result of camp influences alone. I mean, can't we apply that to our life? You know, are we awake to that wisdom? That really, in the end, it's an inner decision. Am I going to be a product of what happens to me insofar as becoming trapped by it or paralyzed by it? Or can I use it for growth, for the evolution of my essence and my soul? He quotes Dostoevsky, who said, "There is only one thing that I dread, not to be worthy of my sufferings." Some of you know me, many of you don't. I can get very emotional by certain things that I read and see. And that line, there's something about that line that makes me feel like I've been pulled up by my bootstraps. There's something about that line from Dostoevsky that makes me feel like, I don't know. It affirms the path that my life has taken, the journey that I have been offered. There is only one thing that I dread, not to be worthy of my sufferings. Because if I am worthy of my sufferings, that means I am engaged in my sufferings. And it is through suffering, I'm sorry to say, that we make the greatest use of our time here on earth. We make the greatest connection of what our soul is, our essence. That cannot be taken from you. What is revealed to you through your own personal suffering is unique to you. It is what molds you. It's what forms you. It's where your purpose lies. Sean Korn said something once, the wonderful yoga teacher Sean Korn, teach from your wounds. But first you must address your wounds, and you must find the source of your wounds, and you must heal your wounds. You never teach as yoga teachers from fresh wounds. That's it's really unethical as a yoga teacher. But teach from your wounds, because in there lies your greatest wisdom. We are all great, wise beings. He says, if there is a meaning in life at all, then there must be a meaning in suffering. Suffering is an ineradicable part of life, forgive me, even as fate and death. Without suffering and death, human life cannot be complete. Without suffering and death, human life cannot be complete. I mean, the Buddha's first noble truth, life is suffering. The second noble truth, find the causations of suffering, find the causes. Find the causes, get to work. The Buddha didn't say life is suffering, let's all go back to bed. The Buddha didn't say life is suffering and holy crap, run for the hills. He said, life is suffering, but hold on a minute. We can find the causes of our suffering. And then once we find the causes of our suffering, we can then find what is necessary to cease the suffering, the cessation of suffering, to get to work on your suffering. And in there lies, well, whatever nirvana means to you. And the Buddha didn't stop at the Four Noble Truths. He went on to the Eightfold Path, which I always have trouble remembering all of them, but it's like right livelihood, right worldview, right action, and so on and so forth, which Mr. Frankl speaks of without ever mentioning the name Buddha. So if there is a meaning in life at all, then there must be a meaning in suffering. And in the bitter fight for self-preservation, he may forget his human dignity and become no more than an animal. Here lies the chance for a man either to make use of or to forego the opportunities of attaining the moral values that a difficult situation may afford him. And this decides whether he is worthy of his sufferings or not. You know, I ask you to ponder the things that you've suffered in your life. We've all gone through crisis and drama and trauma. We've all had heartbreak and betrayal and loss. Are you able to reflect on these moments of suffering in your life and see that because of them, and not in spite of them maybe, but it because of these experiences, something in your life gave way and changed? Now, I'm not saying if we've suffered the loss of loved ones, we're going to all of a sudden wake up one day and go, oh my God, it's so much better here without that person. I'm not talking about that. Grief is a whole nother big thing to consider. But the suffering, the pain, the sorrow, the disappointments, the heartbreak. Are there instances in your life where you have experienced these sufferings and you are able to say, I grew because of them. My life looks completely different than it did before. Or I'm on the path to something else that I wouldn't have been if that hadn't happened or that thing hadn't broke. So one of the things that he also goes into discuss in some detail is happiness. And he talks about this idea of the pursuit of happiness. And he says, happiness is not something that we are meant to pursue, but it's something that must be ensued. And I think of the Declaration of Independence, you know, the pursuit of happiness, or whatever, it says something in there like that, right? But this pursuit of happiness, if we're always trying to pursue happiness, that's when you're chasing something. You're pursuing, you're in pursuit. It's like, I think if you look it up, the definition of the word, it even has like attack in it. You're like going to attack happiness. And some of you may recall in future episodes where I've talked about the sutra regarding happiness and the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And Swami Sachidananda likes to use the story of the musk deer, right? So the musk deer is running through the forest trying to get this really cool smell, trying to find out where this really great musky smell is coming from. But he doesn't realize that the musk scent is coming from his own forehead. Right, so happiness is within, and it is something that all of nature desires. But this exhaustive pursuit or exhausting pursuit of, I got to go get happiness, it's incorrect. Okay, well, follow me here. And that is that if we realize that happiness is to be ensued, not pursued, then what we realize is happiness is actually an organic, natural byproduct of showing up in our lives in a way where we embrace all that happens, the good, the bad, the light, the dark, the high, the low. We anchor ourselves in this spiritual thing. He uses the word spiritual thing, high spiritual things. And we are able to stay in touch with the happiness that is already within us. It's our intrinsic nature to be happy. In this is where we discover our meaning, our purpose. Okay, so happiness is what ensues when we're living in meaning and in purpose of our life. He talks about, quotes Nietzsche, who says, he who has a why to live for can bear almost, I'm going to repeat that. He who has a why to live for can bear with almost any how. So the meaning is the why. And the how is anything can happen. But when you have meaning and purpose in your life, that you are actively cultivating, and you can seek purpose, But it's actually not as far as you think it is. And we can talk about that in future episodes. It's not very far out there. And you don't have to ask 100 people directions to find your purpose. But it's happiness is what ensues. It's the product that follows, that comes after, because it's already within you. This recognizing that meaning in life is what raises us to our highest incarnation of ourself. And our souls belonging to this story that we have been blessed to be birthed into. He moves on and he says, we need to stop asking about the meaning of life and instead to think of ourselves as those who are being questioned by life daily and hourly. Our answer must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and in right conduct. So I know he does use the word meditation, and, you know, for a moment, a little alarm bell went off and said, meditation is really great. Why is he saying that it's not in meditation? Well, there's a real big reason for this, but I'll give you the short answer. And that is that meditation can be like a kind of chatter if we aren't investigating the certain, let's just talk about the yamas and niyamas in the Eightfold Path of Yoga. You know, if we're really not doing the investigative work of how we're showing up in the world, then meditation can just be a lot of noisy chatter. So what he continues to say is, our answer must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and in right conduct. So that is a nod, if you will, and I'm not saying he was purposely nodding to the Eightfold Path of the Buddha, but, you know, right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. These are the things that come as a next stage, if you will, after the Four Noble Truths. So what that says in my interpretation, which this is just my perspective, is we really need to stop asking about the meaning of life and instead to think of ourselves as those who were being questioned by life. So we're being questioned by life. What do you want out of life? What are your desires? That's when happiness will ensue, when you are able to answer the questions of what drives you? You know, why are you here? I know that sounds like a biggie, but what really brings you joy and helps you to feel like, helps you feel a sense of fulfillment and wholeness? And he repeats here, a man who becomes conscious of the responsibility he bears toward a human being who affectionately waits for him or to an unfinished work will never be able to throw away his life. He knows the why for his existence and will be able to bear almost any how. And this is what he's talking about on the heels of, you know, discussing this idea that we have to instead think of ourselves as those who are being questioned by life. What do you love? Who do you love? And when you know the why for your existence, you can bear almost any how. And in this is where we find our purpose, the meaning for life. So I'm going to end here because there is more that I want to share from Viktor E. Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And that would be in the episode following this one. Thank you all for listening. Hands together at the Heart Center. May all beings be happy and peaceful. May all beings be healthy and strong. May all beings be safe and protected. May all beings live with ease. Namaste.